All right, good morning to all. We'll start a class in just about a few moments, continuing with our exploration into Parshas Kedoshim. And we'll take up the verse today, which is it's Leviticus 19, verse 14. And we'll just about that in a minute or two. Jackie are in Ohio. Good morning to Mike and Jackie, and Joshua, Indiana, and a couple of others have just joined us. All right, wanted to continue with the theme from last week. We were in Parshas Kedoshim, Leviticus 19, and what it's pointing out are, perhaps you could say, in the very, very generally, that there are more subtle types of prohibitions that people would be more readily justified themselves by doing it. They could say, I didn't really kill anybody, I didn't steal, but there are slighter deviations from a really just path that God is really targeting for us. We talked about the idea of God telling Abraham to be tamim, to be perfect. That means not to have any area, as Rabbi Chait would say, not to have any pocket where you have a vent for any emotion. I mean, everything should be in check. If a person is really living properly and following his intelligence, so then he will not be following his emotions in any area. He's going to be following his intelligence, and anytime there's a sense to out an emotion, so he'll be in control of it because his mind tells him it's wrong. Again, we are human, and then there are those times where it does come out, so we have to keep on working on ourselves. So now let's take up the verse here, which is 19:14. So the verse says, do not curse the deaf, and before the blind do not put a stumbling block, and you should fear God. I am your God. Okay. So the first question is, what's the difference between these two? What is the difference between cursing the deaf and putting a stumbling block in front of the blind? And let's just take it on the literal meaning first, because Rashi does go in and say that putting a stumbling block in front of the blind means don't give a bad counsel. That's not going to be good for your friend. So that'll be an example of causing the blind to stumble. He doesn't know much about an area. He's looking to you for advice. He's going to follow it. So you give him the advice, but you know it's going to hurt him because that's what we have to do, is that we have to fill in the blanks. So what is the motivation here? What is the corruption? And also, what is the difference between cursing the deaf and causing the blind to stumble? All right, so take a minute, think about that, and then you'll let me know what you're thinking.
So I'm wondering what the motivation for the first part would be in the first place. As in, why would somebody curse the deaf? Would it be because, gee, they can't hear me and that's frustrating to me because I can't communicate with them, so I will curse them?
No.
That doesn't seem to make sense to me.
No, I wouldn't say that that's the reason. I mean, if you have a very close friend and they're deaf, I don't think you're going to curse them because you just can't speak to them. You'll work out some form of communication.
Right. So what would cause you to curse a deaf person in the first place?
What would cause you to oppress the convert or the widow or the orphan? The Torah talks about that.
Well, the oppression of the widow and the orphan, it seems, would come from the fact that they are helpless or appear to be, and that I could somehow get away with that and somehow get some imagined gain.
But why does a person do that to begin with? The guy lives in a certain town, and he's living there for 20, 30, 40 years. All of a sudden, some widow or an orphan moves into the town, doesn't know him, and then all of a sudden he is now tempted to oppress him. Evidently that temptation must be there. If there's no temptation whatsoever, God will not make a command against it.
Well, it seems like there would have to be an underlying temptation to want to have some kind of power over people, or to take advantage of those who are weaker than you.
Okay, what do we call that? What part of the personality is it called?
The ego?
Exactly. So we have the reason already. We are born with the reason to be aggressive and vicious, and there's a need for the elevation of the self. That is supposed to be conquered, of course. Okay, Joshua was suggesting that the causing the blind to stumble seems to cause immediate damage to the other person. Or it could be prolonged. I don't know if it's immediate, but the question, of course, what the motivation is. You could do damage to a person in a more direct way, Joshua. You don't have to, like for example, I think it's the Ramban or Sforna that says that when you put a stumbling block up, so it's not you who's doing it. Yeah, Sforna. Sforna says that even though you didn't damage the blind person with your hands, you nonetheless were the causative agent. So I didn't push the guy over a fence. I saw him walking in a certain path, and I calculated, you know, where the path will take him, and I put up I dug a hole in the road, or I put a brick in the road that he's going to trip over and fall down and hurt himself. So I didn't cause him in a direct sense, but I allowed his own walking to be met by a block and that he didn't anticipate. So you see, Sforno is honing in on the fact that it's more of passive. It's a passive aggressiveness. And I would definitely say that applies to any passive aggression, that this type of a concept. Right? And yes, Josh, you know, cursing is more of an emotional outlet. Interesting what the Sforno says on that. Well, you tell me what the difference is. Right, but let's let's understand. So Doug, so we're saying that it's ego.
Well, I mean, you could say, well, by putting down someone who appears to be in a more, what's the right word, restricted state, or that has some, what my ego could appear to be a flaw, it somehow makes me feel better. But it still doesn't seem like it would be a natural thing to do.
Well, a natural, I don't know, a natural, not, I mean, let's just differentiate here. In terms of cursing, or let's say not cursing, oppressing the widow, the convert, the orphan, there we already spoke about that in the past, and we said that these people have no one to defend them. So they're an easy mark. I could outlet my viciousness without any fear of retribution. Who's this woman, or the orphan, or the gare? I mean, they have no, there's no one to stick up for them. So there is a natural, again, just because something's natural doesn't mean that it's wholesome. Everything has to be analyzed and worked with and contained and abided by in terms of the format of the Torah, the structure of the laws. So although we're born with ego, ego evidently is an important thing. Otherwise, God wouldn't have, you know, placed it in each one of us. But the natural disposition to outlet the viciousness and to do it in a safe way. So that's what that's hitting on when it says don't oppress the gare, the orphan, and the widow, because they're easy targets. So, and you think, you know, what type of a boor, what type of an insensitive human being is going to go over to a 10-year-old orphan and be oppressive? Well, there are people who like that. They really have an aggressive streak, and they look to satisfy it, and they just don't have the sensibilities. And it's very safe. And we all have that capacity. Nobody's different. Everybody has the capacity to be a Hitler, because he was not created with any different design than us. And I believe it was Rabbi Chayder said that the reason why they didn't stop Hitler in time is because people did not want to face in themselves the reality of what they were hearing. That somebody can butcher millions of people? Oh, come on. So that would mean that now means the human condition can do that. That means I can do it too. So that was something that was distasteful to the person's own sense of self. So we have this as well. So we have to be, you know, to me, you know, it's of course it's a very simple thing. You don't take advantage. You know, an orphan, a widow. You know, the gear, you're sensitive to them. But some people have to learn that type of sensibility. But the bottom line is the fact that the command is there means that there is that tendency. Now here, when you're cursing the deaf and you're putting a stumbling block in front of the blind, now let's see what are the new facets that exist within that area of the ego, the aggressiveness. What is this telling us about our natures?
That they're naturally aggressive?
Well, that we know. That we posited already. We agree.
That we're competitive by nature?
Okay, good. So now it brings in, you're right, that there's this is all dealing with the social environment, dealing with others. There's the competition, again, which is basically, you know, part of the whole ego. Ego is really not expressed if a person lives on a desert island.
Rabbi, could another term for ego be the evil inclination?
No, the evil inclination is a all-inclusive term for all of the instinctual drives. So not just ego, there's many things. There's aggressiveness, there's stealing. I mean, a lot of them do smack of ego too. You steal because you feel you're more important than the other person, so that his money should really be mine. So there's ego there as well. But what we're trying to do here is also understand what is this new point about cursing the deaf. And Josh is saying that if the person who hears you, so then he can retaliate. So here, when you curse the deaf, he can't retaliate. So it's a safe type of a thing. All right, so that's good. Sforno said that you're damaging his reputation because other people will hear about it. So it's a way to hurt him. But again, you're picking somebody who's deaf or a similar, a parable to somebody who's just completely unaware of something that you're doing. So if you hurt a person and they're unaware of what you're doing, but it's in terms of the reputation, you see. Meaning you're now, cursing attaches to what part of the person, as opposed to a stumbling block. What is the object of attack when you curse, as opposed to the object of attack when you put a stumbling block in front of the blind? Let's ask the question that way.
Well, a stumbling block is really dealing with a particular action and wanting them to be unsuccessful in some particular thing.
Okay.
When you curse them, you're talking about their essence, the whole person.
Okay, you could say it better. There's something more than just the essence.
Well, I mean, you're saying that their soul never should have lived in the first place. It should be completely destroyed.
Well, are you hurting the physical body?
No.
No. You're not making them fall down and bruise their knees like with a stumbling block. So wherein is the hurt to the person? Is there any damage to the person when you curse them?
Well, are we presuming that when it says you shall not curse the deaf? Well, wait a second. First of all, are we presuming that the person is there present to hear the curse? And second, if they're deaf, they can't hear it anyway.
Right.
So there can't be any psychological or personal damage to the deaf from this.
Correct. So where would there be a damage? I mean, if a person's cursing, he must feel in his mind that he is doing something to the other person.
Well, usually people in our society curse because they're angry.
That's a curse because, you know, something, you were frustrated. But we're talking about when you curse the person.
Well, that, I guess, gets back to my first question. I don't understand why someone would do that. I mean, it...
Well, I'll read you the Sforno. The Sforno says, you're damaging his reputation, his honor. So, and like Josh is saying, cursing affects the people around who can hear, meaning I'm now, it's the person's name. That's what I'm now taking aggression against, and that's a real thing. You see that the Torah says you can't curse your parents and God and even the princes and the kings, you can't curse. Meaning we look at the name, the reputation as a real thing. So cursing means where a person is now going to, and it could be like you're saying, it's the summation of the whole person, his essence. But I just wanted to pinpoint wherein is the object of the person's aggression attacking. It's not the body of the person, which is by the stumbling block, or the money. If I give the guy bad advice, or I tell him to invest in a stock that I know is plummeting, so he'll lose all his money because I don't like this guy for whatever reason. So, like Sforno says, I didn't do the action, it was causative. I gave him advice, but then he listened to the advice. If he didn't listen to my advice, I would not have been contributing to anything bad. The Gemara, the Talmud, actually talks about a question. When a person gives bad counsel, so the, I think it's on Talmud Avodah Zarah 6b. We were just doing it last week, and it talks about this very concept. When does a person violate putting a stumbling block in front of a person? Is it, for example, let's say a guy is a nazir. So a nazir is a person who vowed for at least 30 days not to have wine. All right, he's trying to perfect himself. He's trying to go to the opposite extreme and hopefully balance out in the middle. So he says he's not going to have wine. So now wine is prohibited to him. Now, if I go over to him and I stretch out my hand with a glass of wine to tempt him, so the Talmud has a question. Am I violating putting a stumbling block in front of a person? The Gemara talks about it. The Talmud says, well, it depends. does this Nazirite have wine of his own or not? So the initial thought of the Talmud is that it wouldn't matter whether he has his own. Even if he has his own wine, you're still in violation of causing somebody to stumble. The conclusion of the Talmud is no. It has to be that he has no wine and you are now giving it to him. So what would you say is the dispute? What is the Talmud disputing over there? When it asked the question, when does a person violate putting a stumbling block in front of a person? Is it even in a case where he's got the ability to sin himself, he has his own wine, and he's not allowed to drink wine because he made a Nazirite vow. So it doesn't matter that he has his own wine. If I'm sticking my hand out to give him some, I'm still in violation of putting a stumbling block. Or no, I'm only in violation if he has no wine. So then I'm presenting the wine to him, and otherwise he wouldn't be able to do it. But the question is now, what's the theory of both sides? Okay, that's the question. Everybody have it clear?
I think so. So the theory, if you gave it to him, regardless of whether he had it, I mean, even if he has it, would be that you are attempting to entice him to break his vow. And that the means isn't really important.
Okay, and what's the other side?
The other side would be that you are only attempting to break you are only violating the commandment if you are introducing. think about how to make this work.
Yes, it's believe me, I worked on this question for a while.
Yeah, you've probably been down all the alleyways.
It was it seemed very simple. You know, the amount of facts are very simple. Oh, this is going to be an easy one to solve. But then when you try to really pinpoint it, it's a little elusive. When am I actually violating it? What are the theories? Mike and Jackie in Ohio, I'm not sure what you're saying. You're saying only if you know. I'm not sure what you mean. Unless you're addressing Joshua. Joshua, you were saying, is cursing the deaf basically the same as cursing behind somebody's back? Yes, Joshua, I would say that.
So, if the person has wine in their house.
In the Nazirite.
Yeah.
Right.
Has wine in his house.
Right.
And all you do is go get the bottle and pour him a glass. Then are you violating his, are you doing a stumbling block or are you just doing a kind act?
What do you mean? You know the guy's a Nazirite and you're trying to tempt him with a sin. And Mike and Jackie, you're saying only if the person knows he is not drinking. I don't know what you mean. If you just spell that out a little bit more. See, evidently, if you didn't put your hand out with the wine, even if he's got his own, so he knows he's not supposed to be drinking. And evidently he's not drinking yet, because if he's in the middle of drinking wine, so you're not making him do the sin. He did the sin already himself. Right?
Right.
So evidently this guy who took a Nazirite vow is not in the state. He's keeping it right now. He's supposed to keep 30 days of not drinking. So now he's on day 15. He's successful. He's not drinking at all. And you walk over to him with a glass of wine. Now, even though he's got his own wine, the Talmud's first opinion is that you are still in violation of putting a stumbling block. The last case is easier. The last case where, I mean, the conclusion of the Talmud is that you only violate it if he doesn't have any wine at all. Because without you, so then he couldn't do it, right?
Well, but then it seems like then you're getting into proximity. For example, I mean, suppose he lives in a 1,500 square foot house, and the wine is in the house. Okay? Well, then we could ask the question, what if the wine is right next to the door but inside the door? What if the wine is right outside the door?
Well, it doesn't matter. If he owns the wine and it's, you know, in California, he lives in New York, he can have it FedEx to him the next day. The thing is that if he has the wine, is what they're talking about. He owns it.
So they're talking, the definitive line is the ownership aspect.
Right.
Okay. And the argument is made there, if he owns it, then you give it to him, that you're not in violation. But if he doesn't own it and you bring it, you are in violation.
Yeah, well, you're not giving him his own wine when he owns it. You're giving him yours.
Oh, in all cases here.
Yeah.
So he has a bottle of Cabernet on his shelf, but I go get some Pinot Noir from my kitchen and I bring him over a glass.
Yes, with some cheese and crackers.
Yeah, okay.
See, this is, I'm bringing this up because what the Sforno said, and this is a hint, the Sforno said that when you put a stumbling block in front of somebody, even though you didn't push him down and hurt him, and it was due to his own walking, nonetheless, you are causatively involved, because without you putting the stumbling block there, he wouldn't have fallen. True, he has to be walking too in order that he falls down. So you're not the exclusive cause. But you are a causative agent, he's saying. I think that's what the point is over here in the Talmud, that even if the man has his own wine, it doesn't matter. Because as long as I contribute to the sin, I put my hand out with a glass of wine to him, and he drinks it. It doesn't matter that he had his own, he could have done it himself. The violation, according to the first thought of the Talmud, is that any contribution to the sin is a violation. Okay? Whereas the conclusion of the Talmud is that, no, it has to be that you are the exclusive cause. So that means he hasn't had his own wine, and without you, he could not violate it. So that's how the Talmud concludes. You must be the exclusive cause of the sin. But the initial thought of the Talmud was that, no, even if you contribute, perhaps that's enough to be a violation. Okay?
And that is the halakhic conclusion.
Yeah, that's how the Gemara concludes there. I mean, I have to continue more of the Talmud to see if they revisit that with other views, but at that point it seems that's the conclusion. It doesn't seem to be any dispute.
So, if he opens the bottle, and then it's sitting on the other side of the kitchen, and says to me, Doug, will you pour me a glass of wine, and I just pour his, then theoretically, the first argument would have said I'm in violation, but the last argument would say I'm not.
That's correct. But at least here in the case of misleading a person into a sin, you're actually doing a damage to the person himself. Here, it's even worse because now it's a spiritual damage. If you just put a stumbling block and he just falls down, he'll get up. But, you know, that's prohibited as well, of course. But cursing to death is not even there. Cursing is now where it attaches to the name, the reputation of the person. It's a different way of a person aggressively relating to another. And that's why there's so many ramifications. That's why you have so many cases here.
Well, I suppose you could theorize that because, and if we go to the word, you shall not place a stumbling block before the blind, that if the guy has wine already, he has already placed a stumbling block in his own situation, and you're not placing a stumbling block. All you're doing is facilitating him, you know.
Well, no, you're presenting, you're giving him the opportunity. That itself is what the Talmud seems to be entertaining. And the first thought, all you do, you just introduce the concept of sinning right now. Even though he's, you know, very well equipped to do it himself with his own possessions. Nonetheless, you introduced that, you enticed him towards sin. That's the initial thought of the Talmud, is that that's a violation.
Yeah, I'm having trouble not agreeing with the first case.
You're having trouble not agreeing? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, in other words, it seems like the Talmud's first position makes the most sense.
Yeah. Well, we could see, the point is to see both sides here.
Right, and I'm trying to figure out what the definitive dividing line is, or the...
Well, it's whether, are you quantitatively involved in the guy doing the sin? Or am I giving him the quality of the sin, meaning I am presenting the entire quality, I am the exclusive cause?
It seems like there's got to be a qualitative difference between the first and the last positions of the Talmud.
Yeah, the difference is, again, is in terms of how much involvement the Torah is requiring. For example, let's say to define what is considered non-kosher. Is non-kosher something which is 100% pork product? Or could non-kosher also even be something which is only 50% or 2%? So the question is, you know, you can see a difference between what is defined as what is kosher or not. Is it as long as the quality is present, it doesn't matter, even if it's still 1%, the quality is there. You have the quality of pork in a mixture, so then you can't eat it, according to one view. Another view might say, no, it's because you're not considered eating a pork object that's only 1%. Even if it's 50%, it's not a pork object. We don't define it as pork unless it's all pork. So, again, you see another example of how the quantitative aspect will determine. Somebody's dying. They're falling out of a building. And before they hit the ground, and they're falling, let's say, from the tallest building in the world, so there's no way they're going to live, right? So before they hit the ground, I shoot them in the head. Am I worthy of being killed now? The answer is no. Because here, the person now had a different status because it was inevitable that they were going to die. Similarly, if somebody throws a beautiful vase off the top of a 60-story building, and before it hits the ground, I shoot the vase and I destroy it. Am I obligated to pay for the worth of that vase? No, because the vase at that point had a different status. You may say I contributed in some measure, but I was not the exclusive cause of why that vase is destroyed right now. There was no way that vase was going to be safe. It was heading for a tar surface, which was very solid. It was going to shatter, and that's it. So the Torah will give a different status, even for the same exact activity. Whereas if I go to your house and I shoot that vase that's sitting on your counter, I have to pay you for it. Even though my action was exactly the same, I took a gun out, or I took a baseball bat and I shattered it. In both cases, my action was the same, but the results are different, depending on how the halacha had viewed my participation.
So then, using that as an analogy, would we say that the Nazir is in a state where he has, I'm not sure the right words, but set himself up for sin by owning the wine?
Right.
And therefore, my bringing him a cup is not moving him further into that state. But if he doesn't own the wine, and then I bring him some, then I am responsible for moving him into a state where he's about to sin.
Okay, you can say that. I am, meaning the Talmud is saying at the end, you must be the exclusive cause of his violation.
Right.
And
not exclusive cause if he already has the stuff sitting around his house.
Exactly. And that's what Rezora is touching on. She's writing, if you offer his own wine, you are not really introducing a new temptation because he already could drink it. Right. But again, we're not giving any conclusions here. We're just debating what the theories are on both sides. All right?
So we're having to define a state, if you will, or a condition.
Well, here we're defining participation, meaning when I violate the leading somebody astray, so when did I do it? Is it any participation, or is it exclusive participation?
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so I have to end early today. I have to head out, but I'll leave you with a question. The question would be, is like this. What would happen if the person didn't drink the wine? In either case, was I in violation? All right? Meaning, does my temptation have to result in his sin in order that I violate? That's the question. Or am I scot-free if he didn't drink the wine? Whether he had the wine or he didn't have the wine. I mean, if he never drinks it, did I do anything wrong? Think about that, and I'll see if I can find an answer, because I don't have one at this point. There's actually a question that I can't remember who mentioned it to me this week, but it's a good question. Alrighty?
Okay.
All right, let me see here, what else? Yeah, I think that would do it, all right. Okay, so we'll continue with this on a week from today. What's today, the 25th? So what is it, June 1st is next Sunday?
Let's see. I can tell you real quick here. Yes, it is.
June 1st. Okay, so next Sunday we'll continue and we'll try to answer this question. See if you have answers yourself. And, all right. Interesting. Interesting stuff. All righty then. Have a good week to everybody. Sorry it's a little bit short today, but left you with some food for thought. So I hope we'll pick up next week. All right?
Yep. It's a good problem, Rabbi. Thanks very much.
Okay. Have yourself a good week, everybody.
You too.
Okay.
Bye.